a woman's right to an abortion, was established more than 40 years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade decision. But as we know, that did not end the abortion debate. In her recent book, Pro, Katha Pollitt lays out the pro-choice argument. She told Marcy Silman that abortion was legal in just about every state until after the Civil War.
So that means, you know, abortion was legal during the American Revolution, when George and Martha were living in Mount Vernon, when the Constitution was written. And I think that abortion has changed its meaning. I think now abortion is associated with women being independent and with smaller families, and that frightens a lot of people who think that they imagine that in the past women were not controlling their fertility in this way, but they were. Even when abortion was illegal, there were tremendous numbers of them in the United States.
So what you're saying is it's an anti-woman attitude as much as it is an anti-abortion attitude?
I think that there is a piece of it that's about controlling women. I know that makes me sound like some kind of, you know, radical feminist from the 1970s, but I think it's true. And I think another piece of it is a lot of people think America's going to hell in a handbasket. There's too much sex, too much people just doing what they want, not being responsible. There's just a sense that society is in a kind of state of decadence. And so they fix on abortion for those two reasons. And if only we could criminalize abortion, you know, people would be good. But, of course, that isn't what happens when you criminalize abortion.
I'm talking with Katha Pollitt. She's an essayist and columnist for The Nation, and her new book about abortion rights is called Pro. I'm old enough to remember the 1973 Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision. I remember it being hailed by feminists as a landmark ruling. But what do you think that the effect of that ruling has been on the abortion debate?
Well, I think once abortion became legal, it became more a subject for people to weigh in on, that the balance went from women having to go to extraordinary lengths to end a pregnancy to it being much easier to end a pregnancy. And I think a lot of people didn't like that, because that's when you began to see this division between the good abortion and the bad abortion. The good abortion is the one where you're pregnant for reasons beyond your control, like rape or incest, or there's some catastrophic health situation involved, the life of and health of the mother, or the life and health of the future baby. And then there are all these other abortions that are just women being promiscuous, women being too lazy to use birth control, and women, you know, rejecting their maternity, which is their natural default position. And I think all that became very clear. But there's one other thing, which is I think that the Republican Party very consciously allied itself with the religious right and made this into a big political issue that they could use to fundraise on, and they could use it as one of these wedge issues to win conservative religious Christians to their side.
The other thing that I had forgotten in the four decades since this ruling was handed down, or maybe it was always there, is that it was a ruling that gave access to abortion rights based on the right of privacy, but it is not private at this point, you argue in your book.
Oh, I think it's one of the least private things women do, you know. Let's say you go to a clinic and there are a bunch of screaming fanatics calling you a baby killer. It's very shameful if people know you've had an abortion. There are actually political, campaigns where "she had an abortion" becomes an issue. For example, I believe it was in Mississippi, one candidate said, "Well, let's both sign affidavits that we haven't had an abortion," which was her way of saying that the other candidate had an abortion. I think there's very little privacy around this now, and I think that's really, really too bad.
Is it because it becomes something that somebody can use as a cudgel against them?
Well, I think it's very stigmatizing. I think that the first thing that comes to mind when people think about women who have abortions is not, here is a woman exercising responsible fertility. Here is a woman making a decision that has actually put her in a good place in her life. It's, she's a slut. She hates children. She did this bad thing. And I think that stigmatization And the good, bad abortion thing that I mentioned earlier makes women afraid to talk about it. I met somebody the other day when I was at a book festival in Minnesota who said to me, well, I've never talked about my abortion. And I said, well, what do you think would happen if you did? And she says, I haven't even told my best friend. What would happen if you did? I said, and she said, she'd probably tell me she had had one too. So here are these two best friends, and they each have the same secret.
I'm talking with Katha Pollitt. Her new book about abortion is called Pro. You, in fact, as you're telling me this story, I'm realizing that the very first sentence in your book is about a secret that your mother carried from you.
Yes, my mother had an illegal abortion in 1960. She never told me. And then it turned out, get this, my great-grandmother had an abortion during World War I.
Wow.
Back in Russia, you know? And you know, we think now of abortion as, you know, this very bold thing that women do to reject motherhood. But that is a false way of seeing it. The woman who has an abortion, like my mother and like my great-grandmother, are mothers. 60% of women who have abortions already have children, and they are the woman with the abortion and the woman with the kid are the same woman at different points in her life.
So you've been traveling around the country on talking about your book, meeting people, and you just recounted a story about somebody who's never talked about an abortion she had. How do you change the conversation around abortion to swing it more the way that you would like to see it go? What is it? What has to happen?
Well, you know, I think what I'm saying is not, you know, so very revolutionary. I think that it's what a lot of people already think, but they've somehow been almost kind of morally bullied into not bringing up these points. And instead, because the anti-choice movement has been so successful in putting all the energy and moral focus on the fertilized egg now, where we're at that stage, the fertilized egg, the embryo, and the fetus. So they've made it seem as though the typical abortion happens, you know, like the day before birth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in fact, more than half of abortions take place, you know, before the 8th week of pregnancy. And almost 90% take place in the first trimester. So, you know, we really shouldn't be spending all this energy on fantastical philosophical conundrums about if you can have an abortion of a fertilized egg, then you can have one the day before birth, because none of that is true.
Do you imagine a time where people are back in the streets, keep your laws off my body, signs waving?
Well, I sure hope so. I think there's still a lot of complacency out there. I think that you know, up until quite recently, the severest restrictions have been in states that are small and far away from most media, like North Dakota. Mm. But now we're seeing that there are major restrictions in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in Missouri. Missouri now has one abortion clinic. And as if that wasn't making it hard enough for women to have an abortion in that state, they've passed a 72-hour waiting period. So my hope is that as people come to realize how close we are to losing access and, you know, maybe down the road rights as well, that they will wake up, both men and women.
Katha Pollitt, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Marcy.
Katha Pollitt, essayist, columnist for The Nation, and her new book about abortion rights is called Pro. She spoke with Marcy Silman.